By no means all of those who have supported the movement in one way or another were actual party members. The membership took the party oath, which in effect amounted to an abdication of personal intelligence and moral responsibility. This was the oath. I vow inviolable fidelity to Adolf Hitler. I vow absolute obedience to him and to the leaders he designates for me. Nor did they take this vow with their tongue in their cheeks. The membership in daily practice followed its leaders with an idolatry and self-surrender that was more oriental than Western. We shall not be obliged to guess as to the motives or goal of the Nazi Party. The immediate aim was to undermine the Weimar Republic. The order to all party members to work to that end was given in a letter from Hitler of August 24th, 1931, to the defendant Rosenberg. Shall I suspend a moment or continue? Of this letter, we will produce the original. And Hitler complains to Rosenberg about an article appearing in his newspaper. And he says that the tendency of the article is to prevent, on our part, a crumbling away from the present form of government. I myself am traveling all over Germany to achieve exactly the opposite. May I therefore ask that my own paper will not stab me in the back with tactically unwise articles. Captured film will enable us to present to you the defendant, Alfred Rosenberg, who from the screen will himself tell you his story. The SA practiced violent interference with the elections of Germany. We have the reports of the SD describing in detail how its members violated the secrecy of elections in order to identify those who opposed them. The report on the 7th of May, 1938 will be offered to you in due course and points out exactly the method by which some members of the election committee marked all the ballots with numbers and made up a list. And it points out how this resulted in it was marked with skim milk, by the way, and points out how they were then enabled to bring back the markings and to identify all those who ventured to oppose the Nazi Party in the elections. The party activity, in addition to all the familiar forms of political contest that we know about, took on an aspect of rehearsal for warfare. It utilized a party formation which has been described to you in the indictment as the SA. This was a voluntary organization of youthful and fanatical Nazis trained for the use of violence under semi-military despotism. Its members began by acting as bodyguards for the Nazi leaders, and they rapidly expanded from defensive to offensive tactics. They became disciplined ruffians for breaking up opposition meetings and terrorization of adversaries. They boasted that their task was to make the Nazi Party the master of the streets. The SA was the parent organization of a number of others, such as the SS formed in 1925, and distinguished throughout this evidence for the fanaticism and cruelty of its members. Then there was the SD and the state secret police, the infamous Gestapo, formed in 1934 immediately after the Nazi accession to power. A glance at the charts, and we shall offer to you in evidence in due course a complete chart of the Nazi Party. I'll not take time to point out more than these things significant at this point in the argument. It was organized on semi-military lines. It had chiefs of staff of the stormtroopers. It had an elite guard and a motor corps. And it had a flying corps. It had a chief of legal office, the defendant Frank headed, and a party Supreme Court, which passed upon membership's activities. Throughout, it had a death's head corps, too, which was not misnamed. Presents nothing, as you will see when this chart is placed in evidence. It presents nothing that resembles what you or I know in our respective countries as political parties. It had its own source of law in the Führer and the Subführer, more absolute than any parliament. It had its own courts and its own police. The conspirators set up a government within the party to exercise outside of the law every sanction that a legitimate state could exercise and many that it could not. Its chain of command was military, and its formations were martial in name as well as in function. It established elaborate administrative mechanisms to identify and liquidate spies and informers, to manage concentration camps, to operate death vans, and to finance the whole movement. Through concentric circles of authority, the Nazi Party, as its leadership boasted, eventually organized and dominated every phase of German life, but not until they had waged a bitter internal struggle characterized by the brutal criminality we charge here. In preparation for this phase of their struggle, they created the party police system, which became the pattern and the instrument of the police state, which was the final goal of their plan in Germany. These party formations, including the leadership corps of the party, the SD, the SS, the SA, and the infamous state secret police or Gestapo, all these stand accused before you as criminal organizations. Organizations which, as we will prove from their own documents, were recruited only from recklessly devoted Nazis, ready in conviction and temperament to do the most violent deeds to advance the common program. They terrorized and silenced democratic opposition and were able at length to combine with political opportunists, militarists, industrialists, monarchists, and political reactionaries. On the 30th of January, 1933, Adolf Hitler became Chancellor of the German Republic. An evil combination, represented in the prisoner's dock by its most eminent survivors, had succeeded in possessing itself of the machinery of the German government, a facade behind which they thenceforth would operate, to make a reality of the war of conquest which they long had plotted. The conspiracy had passed into its second phase. We shall now consider the steps which embraced the most hideous of crimes against humanity, to which these conspirators resorted in perfecting their control of the German state and in preparing Germany for the aggressive war which was indispensable to their ends. The Germans of the 1920s were a frustrated and baffled people. as the result of defeat and disintegration of their traditional government. The democratic elements, which were trying to govern Germany through the new and feeble machinery of the Weimar Republic, got inadequate support from the democratic forces of the rest of the world, including my country. It is not to be denied that Germany, when worldwide depression was added to her other problems, was faced with urgent and intricate problems and pressures in her economic and political life, which necessitated bold measures. The internal nation measures by which a nation attempts to solve its problems are ordinarily no concern to other nations. But the Nazi program from the first was recognized as a desperate program for a people still suffering the effects of an unsuccessful war. The Nazi policy embraced ends recognized from the beginning as attainable only by a renewal and a more successful outcome of the war in Europe. The conspirators' answer to Germany's problems was nothing less than to plot the regaining of territories lost in the First World War and the acquisition of other fertile lands of Central Europe by dispossessing or exterminating those who inhabited them. They also contemplated, and I want to emphasize this point for it runs through the whole Nazi history, they also contemplated destroying or permanently weakening all other neighboring peoples so as to win virtual domination over Europe and probably of the world. The precise limits of their ambition we need not define, for it was and is as illegal to wage an aggressive war for small stakes as for large ones. We find at this period of time two governments in Germany, the real and the ostensible. The forms of the German Republic were maintained for a time, and it was the outward and visible government. But the real authority in the state was outside of and above the law, and rested in the leadership core of the Nazi Party, with whose doings you will be continuously concerned. On February 27, 1933, less than a month after Hitler became Chancellor, the Reichstag building was set on fire. The burning of this symbol of free parliamentary government was so providential for the Nazis that it was believed they set the fire themselves. Certainly, when we contemplate their known crimes, we cannot believe that they would shrink from mere arson. It is not necessary, however, to resolve the controversy as to who set the fire. The significant point is the use that was made of the fire and of the state of public mind it produced. The Nazis immediately accused the Communist Party of instigating and committing the crime and turned every effort to portray this single act of arson as the beginning of a communist revolution. Then, taking advantage of the hysteria, the Nazis met this phantom revolution with a real one. In the following December, the German Supreme Court, with commendable courage and independence, acquitted the accused communists. But it was too late to influence the tragic course of events which the Nazi conspirators had set rushing forward. Hitler, on the morning after the fire, obtained from the aged and ailing President von Hindenburg a presidential decree suspending the extensive guarantees of individual liberty contained in the Constitution of the Weimar Republic. That decree provides in Article 1 that Sections 114, 115, 117, 118, 123, 124, and 153 of the Constitution of the German Reich are suspended until further notice. It goes on. Thus, restrictions on personal liberty, on the right of free expression of opinion, including freedom of the press, on the right of assembly and the right of association, and violations of the privacy of postal, telegraphic, and telephonic communications, and warrants for house searches, orders for confiscations, as well as restrictions on property, are permissible beyond the legal limits otherwise prescribed. Now, the Weimar Constitution contained extensive guarantees of personal freedom. 114, which the decree suspended, had provided that the freedom of the person is inviolable. Curtailment or deprivation of personal freedom by a public authority is only permissible on a legal basis. Persons who have been deprived of their freedom must be informed at the latest on the following day by whose authority and for what reasons the deprivations of freedom were ordered. Opportunity shall be afforded them without delay of submitting objections to their deprivations of freedom. Article 115 provided that every German's home is his sanctuary and is inviolable. Exceptions may be made as provided by law. 117 provided for the secrecy of the mails. 118 provided freedom of speech in language which might have been applicable in any of our countries. 123 gave the right to peaceably assemble without notice and without special permission. And 124 gave them the right to form associations and societies for purposes not contrary to criminal law. And 153 guaranteed their rights of property. All of these guarantees of the Weimar Constitution were swept away by the Hitler-Hindenburg decree the morning after the fire. Now, it must be said, in fairness to von Hindenburg, that the Constitution itself authorized him temporarily to suspend these fundamental rights, quoting, "if the public safety and order in the German Reich are considerably disturbed or endangered." It must also be acknowledged, in fairness, that President Ebert previously had invoked his power. But the National Socialist coup was made possible because the terms of the Hitler-Hindenburg decree departed from all previous ones.
Pardon me. Not a minute, you run beyond the translation.
I'm warned that the translating may be having difficulty to keep up with me. I shall try to adjust myself to the pace. Whenever President Ebert had suspended constitutional guarantees of individual rights, his decree had expressly revived the Protective Custody Act adopted by the Reichstag in 1916 during the previous war. This act guaranteed a judicial hearing within 24 hours of arrest, gave a right to have counsel and to inspect relevant records, provided for an appeal, and authorized compensation from the Treasury for erroneous arrests. The Hitler-Hindenburg decree of February 28, 1933, contained no such safeguards. The omission may not have been noted by Hindenburg. Certainly, he did not appreciate its effect. It left the Nazi police and party formations already existing and functioning under Hitler completely unrestrained and irresponsible. Secret arrest and indefinite detention without charges, without evidence, without hearing, without counsel became the method of inflicting human punishment on any whom the Nazi police suspected or disliked. No court could issue an injunction or writs of habeas corpus or certiorari. The German people were in the hands of the police. The police were in the hands of the Nazi Party, and the party was in the hands of a ring of evil men, of whom the defendants here before you are the surviving and representative leaders. The Nazi conspiracy, as we shall show, always contemplated. Not merely overcoming current opposition, but it contemplated exterminating elements which could not be reconciled with the Nazi philosophy of the state. It not only sought to establish the Nazi New Order, but to secure its sway, as Hitler predicted, for 1,000 years. The Nazis were never in doubt or disagreement as to what these dissident elements were. They were concisely described by one of them, Colonel General von Frisch, on December 11, 1938, in these words, which I emphasize because they identify so clearly the object of the Nazi program of extermination. He writes, in a document which will be proven to you, shortly after the First World War, I came to the conclusion that we should have to be victorious in 3 battles if Germany were to become powerful again. First, the battle against the working class. Hitler has won this. This was in 1938. Second, against the Catholic Church, or perhaps better expressed as Ultramontanism. Third, against the Jews. That ends the quote. The warfare against these 3 elements was continuous. The battle in Germany was but a practice skirmish for the worldwide drive against them. We have here, in point of geography and of time, 2 groups of crimes against humanity. One within Germany, before and during the war, and one in occupied territory during the war. But these two are not separate in Nazi planning. They are a continuous unfolding of the Nazi plan to exterminate peoples and institutions which might serve as a focus or instrument for overturning their new world order at any time or place. We consider these crimes against humanity in this opening address as manifestations of the one Nazi plan. And I propose to unfold to you our proposals of proof according to General von Fritsch's classification. First, the battle against the working class. When Hitler came to power, there were in Germany 3 groups of trade unions. The General German Trade Union Confederation, with 28 affiliated unions, and the General Independent Employees Confederation, with 13 federated unions, together numbered 4.5 million members. The Christian Trade Union had over 1,250,000 members. The working people of Germany, like the working people of other nations, had little to gain personally by war. While labor is usually brought around to the support of the nation at war, labor by and large is a pacific, though by no means a pacifist, force in the world. The working people of Germany had not forgotten in 1933 how heavy the yoke of the warlord can be. Moreover, the German working people were identified in the minds of the militarists with the revolution of 1918, when the workers joined with the revolting seamen and soldiers against a continuance of the First World War, an act for which German labor was never forgiven by the military crowd. The Nazi program required that this part of the German population not only be stripped of power to resist diversion of its scanty comforts to armament, but also be wheedled or whipped into new and unheard-of sacrifices as a part of the Nazi war preparation. Labor must be cowed, and that meant that its organizations and means of cohesion and defense must be destroyed. The purpose to regiment labor for the Nazi Party was avowed by Robert Ley in a speech to workers on May 2nd, 1933, in which he said this. You may say, what else do you want? You have the absolute power. True, we have the power, but we do not have the whole people. We do not have you workers 100%, and it is you whom we want. We will not let you be until you stand with us in complete, genuine acknowledgement. The first Nazi attack was upon the two larger unions. On April 21st, 1933, an order, not even in the name of the government, but in the name of the Nazi Party, was issued by the conspirator Robert Lie, describing himself therein as chief of staff of the political organizations of the NSDAP. This order was applicable to the Trade Union Confederation and the Independent Employees Confederation, the two largest of the German unions. It directed seizure of their properties and arrest of their principal leaders. The party order directed the party organs, which we here denounce as criminal associations, the SS and the ASA, to be employed for the occupation of trade union properties and for the taking into custody of personalities who come into question. And it directed taking into protective custody of all chairmen and district secretaries of unions and branch directors of the labor bank. These orders were carried out on May the 2nd, 1933. All funds of the labor unions, including pension and benefit funds, were seized. Union leaders were sent to concentration camps. A few days later, on May 10, 1933, Hitler appointed Robert Lie leader of the German Labor Front, which succeeded to all the confiscated union funds. The German Labor Front, a Nazi-controlled labor bureau, was then set up under Lie to teach the Nazi philosophy to the German workers and to weed out from industrial employment all who were backward in their lessons. Factory troops, as they were called, were organized, and I quote, as an ideological shock squad within the factory, ending the quote. The factory order, the party order provided that outside the German labor front, no other organization, whether of workers or employees, is to exist. On June 24, 1933, the remaining Christian trade unions were seized pursuant to an order, again, of the Nazi Party, signed by Lie. On May 19, 1933, this time by a government decree, it was provided that trustees, and I quote the word trustees, of labor appointed by Hitler should regulate the conditions of all labor contracts, thereby replacing the former process of collective bargaining. On November 30th, a decree regulating national labor introduced the Führer principle into industrial relations. It provided that the owners of the enterprise should be the leaders, or Führers, and the workers should be the followers. And it authorized the owner Führers to, quote, make decisions for employees and laborers in all matters concerning the enterprise. It was by such bait that the great German industrialists were induced to support the Nazi cause to their own ultimate ruin. Not only did the Nazis thus dominate and regiment German labor, but they forced the youth into the ranks of the laboring people they had thus led into chains. Under a compulsory service decree on the 26th of June, 35, young men and women between the ages of 18 and 25 were conscripted for labor. Thus was the purpose to subjugate German labor accomplished. In the words of Lie, this accomplishment consisted, and I quote him, in eliminating the association character of the trade union and employees' associations, and in its place, we have substituted the conception soldiers of work. The productive manpower of the German nation was thus brought under Nazi control and discipline. By these steps, these defendants won the battle to liquidate labor unions as potential opposition and were enabled to impose upon the working class the burdens of preparing for aggressive warfare. Robert Lie, the field marshal of this battle against labor, answered our indictment with suicide. Apparently, he knew no better answer. I take up the battle against the churches, the second in the described elements that must be defeated. The Nazi Party was always predominantly anti-Christian in its ideology. But we who believe in freedom of conscience and of religion base no charge of criminality on anybody's ideology. It is not because the Nazis themselves were irreligious or pagan, but because they persecuted others of the Christian faith that they become guilty of crime. And it is because the persecution was a step in the preparation for aggressive warfare that the offense becomes one of international cognizance. To remove every moderating influence among the German people and to put its population on a total war footing, the conspirators devised and carried out a systematic and relentless repression of all Christian sects and churches. We will ask you to convict the Nazis on their own evidence on this point. Martin Bormann, in June of 1941, issued a secret decree on the relation of Christianity and National Socialism. I quote from it. With the party, its components and attached units, the Führer has created for himself, and thereby the German Reich, leadership, an instrument which makes him independent of the church. All influences which might impair or damage the leadership of the people exercised by the Führer with the help of the National Socialist Party must be eliminated. More and more, the people must be separated from the churches and their organs, the pastors. But never again must an influence on leadership of the people be yielded to the churches. This influence must be broken completely and finally. Only the right government and, by its direction, the party, its components and attached units, have a right to leadership of the people. Just as the deleterious influences of astrologers, seers, and other fakers are eliminated and suppressed by the state, so must the possibility of church influence also be totally removed. Not until this has happened does the state leadership have influence on individual citizens. Not until then are the people and Reich secure in their existence for all the future. And how the party had been securing the Reich from Christian influence will be proved by such items as this telegram from the Gestapo of Berlin to the Gestapo of Nuremberg on July the 24th of 1938, which recites what was going on in Rothenburg. I quote from the Gestapo telegram signed by Dr. Best from the Berlin office of the 24th of July, 1938. In connection with my report, special delivery of 23rd July, 38, subject Bishop Sproul of Rotenburg, I further communicate that the following teletype from the Gestapo office in Stuttgart just came in here. It's now quoted. I have difficulty knowing just when I'm exceeding the... The party, on the 23rd of July, 1939, from 2100 hours, carried out the third demonstration against Bishop Sproul. Participants, about 2,500 to 3,000, were brought in from outside by bus and so forth. The Rotenburg populace again did not participate in the demonstrations. The action got completely out of hand of the party member responsible for it. The demonstrators stormed the palace, beat in the gates and doors. About 150 to 200 people forced their way into the palace, searched the rooms, threw files out of the windows, and rummaged through the beds in the rooms of the palace. One bed was ignited. Before the fire got to the other objects of equipment in the room and palace, the flaming bed could be thrown from the window and the fire extinguished. The bishop was with Archbishop Gruber of Freiburg and the ladies and gentlemen of his menage in the chapel at prayer. About 25 to 30 people pressed into this chapel and molested those present. Bishop Gruber was taken for Bishop Sproul. He was grabbed by the robe and dragged back and forth. Finally, the intruders realized that Bishop Gruber is not the one they are seeking. They could then be persuaded to leave the building.